From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We're very grateful for that support. Please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, Monday is the Canadian Interfaith Celebration of Thanksgiving. And for followers of Judaism, Sukkot continues through Wednesday. Thursday marks Shemini Atzeret, followed by Simchat Torah on Friday. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics this week, Abdullah Antepli of Duke University made history on the Hill. On Wednesday, he became the first imam to offer the opening prayer in the House of Representatives for a second time. There's been a total of exactly 7 Muslim clergy invited to perform the ceremonial role since September of 2001. That's less than 1 every 2 years. The confirmation hearing for Kansas Governor Sam Brownback as the nation's next ambassador for international religious freedom raised some deeply troubling issues as the nominee defended his past actions rolling back protections for LGBT workers as well as past anti-Muslim statements. Meanwhile, a 2014 Justice Department ruling that transgender Americans were covered by protections from sexual discrimination in employment have been summarily rescinded by Attorney General Jeff Sessions. However, for now, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission continues to hold the opposite position as it has since 2012. And the First United Methodist Church in Austin, Texas, is drawing the line on marriage equality. 93% of members recently voted to rescind hosting weddings in the church until the denomination begins allowing marriage for same-sex couples as well. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
Do you think that homosexuality or homosexual conduct should be illegal today? That's a yes or no question.
Homosexual conduct should be illegal. Yes.
Should be illegal.
Yes.
We're not talking the Bible. We're not talking what your faith tells
sure.
you, Roy Moore. We're talking about what this Constitution tells you.
Sure. Morality is based on God. That's why you do not find it in the Constitution. Where do you think we get our morality? From some book of Hinduism or Islam? We get our morality from the Holy Bible upon which this nation was founded.
For so many years, mainstream Americans have dismissed fringe theocratic elements of our culture as powerless and irrelevant. And for all of those years, on this show, we've kept insisting the political religious right is far from dead. More proof came recently in the form of a Republican primary win in Alabama by the notorious Roy Moore. Reporting on many years of that notoriety has been Frederick Clarkson, and he'll be with me later on this week's show.
You have some of the most right-wing hate mongers in this country that are desperately looking for ways to roll back our progress, to roll back our rights, attempting to disguise discrimination in the realm of religious freedom or religious liberty.
Mississippi is perverting religious freedom into some of the most extreme anti-gay legislation yet. The Colorado wedding cake baker case is in the hands of the U.S. Supreme Court. And then there's Roy Ten Commandments Moore in Alabama. Where is all of this headed? I don't think I want to know. But still, I'll ask author, activist, attorney, and friend, Rabbi J. Michelson. But first...
And now, in the presence of God, and in solidarity with houses of worship across the country, may we remember the victims in Las Vegas.
Thank you. On last Tuesday, the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. tolled its bell once for each precious life lost on October 1st in that monstrous mass shooting in Las Vegas, Nevada. It was the culmination of a public presentation by a group of faith leaders from a wide spectrum of traditions, including Interfaith Alliance President Rabbi Jack Moline. Hosting was the Right Reverend Mary Ann Buddy, the Episcopal Bishop of Washington, D.C., and she joins me right now to talk about the role faith communities has in demanding action on gun violence in this country. Bishop Buddy, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you very much.
In your mind, what sets apart faith leaders from other public figures when it comes to galvanizing public attention on a topic as critical as gun violence?
Our role in responding to national tragedies is often as pastoral support and presence for those who are suffering, those who have lost loved ones, those who are caring for loved ones, those who have been traumatized by what has happened. We are the front line of the thoughts and prayers business, if you will. Mm-hmm. And we are also, so we ask, we find ourselves asking questions when time after time after time, both in mass shootings such as the one we've experienced yet again, and also the daily loss of life to gun violence, which statistics tell us now are up to 60 to 70 a day in this country, leads us to ask questions about what are we called to do by God in response to these tragedies that can prevent them in the future. Mm-hmm. And so we don't feel it is a contradiction to call upon the society to look at its relationship to guns and to say that what sets this country apart from other countries around the world, in the developed world, is the proliferation of guns and their increasing with lethal capacity. Mm-hmm. And so we lift our voice saying, yes, of course we pray, yes, of course we are pastorally present, but we do not have to settle for this as the norm in American society. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is our unique contribution. Mm-hmm. There are others who are offering their voice in the public arena, but we consider this an act of faithfulness.
As the death toll has steadily mounted year after year, do you think organized religion as a whole has done its part in addressing the causes of this tragedy?
I do not. I think we could do more. I think we could do more. And I fear that there are many Christian leaders in particular that have been quiet mm-hmm. on this issue, and others who are in support of a really uncontrolled legislative favoritism toward the National Rifle Association's agenda. So I would gently call upon my colleagues across the spectrum of faith to consider ways that we might prevent such tragedies from occurring.
It really feels like the demands of the voting public on the issue of gun control have continually just gone unheard. Do you feel like there's a strategy that hasn't been tried yet, or is it just a matter of not giving up at this point?
That's a very good question. I think one of the greatest dangers we have is despair and the sense that we are powerless to make a difference. Mm-hmm. And so I would say that God calls us to be faithful and to continue to work for a day when, just as, we have had other travesties in this country that were once considered normal, that we as a society then changed by our collective will. Mm-hmm. There was a time in the society when lynching an African American was considered an appropriate response, and that is no longer the case. That is no longer a possibility in this mm-hmm. country. And we have made other changes in our society, and we could change this if we choose. I feel in some ways that we have been as a country seduced by a message that says that not only does the Second Amendment protect our right to bear arms, which it does, and I do not contest, but it has morphed into an argument that says it is therefore our right to possess any kind of gun with whatever lethal capacity the armament industry chooses to market. And mm-hmm. so we have military capacity weapons in the hands of civilians, easily accessible, mm-hmm. and laws that have really undercut our society's ability to control these guns. And I would say, I understand that statistically the majority of Americans voice some approval for the common sense legislation that has been proposed, but there's a significant portion of the population that has been swayed in the other direction. And I pray that with each day, more and more people would come to recognize that we simply as a society do not have to accept this as our norm.
Why is this so different from other lobbying and pressure that comes from the public when we get change in many instances because of the public's pressure, but on this one, it just doesn't work? Why is that?
We're up against a very, very powerful lobby with the National Rifle Association, and also some of the most successful marketing and promotional and propaganda strategies that has been implemented. And so when we say, yes, the majority of the American people, when you look at it state by state and district by district, when certain politicians look at the capacity of the National Rifle Association to deliver both votes and money, their power is considerable. And we would be naive to assume that it's simply a matter of politicians looking the other way. I do believe that as the American populace, we have a responsibility to take back this conversation. And it has to happen on the local level. It mm-hmm. has to happen neighbor by neighbor, church by church, community by community. And so when a country musician looks across what happened in the carnage of Las Vegas and says, I was once a believer in unrestricted access to guns and I am no longer, mm-hmm. that gives me hope, because yes. that's one more chip away at what has been an extraordinarily effective multi-billion-dollar campaign to keep most of us parroting this, or at least significant numbers of us parroting absolute nonsense mm-hmm. about how guns do not kill people. And it is, in fact, without the kind of guns that this man had in his capacity and in his possession on Sunday night, 60 people would not be dead and 500 people would not be fighting for their lives. Mm. And that's a simple fact. But changing hearts on this one is going to be a slow process. And wrenching the power structure away isn't something that will happen just because a few of us are outraged. I can almost give you the mass shooting ritual that happens after this, mm-hmm. after each one. And we've just done it again, and nothing is going to change until we as a people say enough. So we've got work to do.
I'd like for you to talk about the role of the National Cathedral in playing host to such a critically important public conversation as you led this past week.
Oh, well, thank you. What happened was that I came into my ministry, I assumed my post, at the very same time that the previous dean of the cathedral assumed his, which was in the fall of 2011, mm-hmm. which was right at the time of the Sandy Hook massacres, the elementary school shootings. And it was so horrific and so beyond the pale of anything we had experienced, that we believed, as did a good number of people across the country, that surely this would be the event that would catapult us into a soul-searching conversation about the place of guns in our society. And so we organized. And at the time, President Obama established a commission, and there was a study done, and there were some very common sense suggestions made about the restriction, not of gun ownership, but of particular policies and laws and certain firearms that would be prohibited, and universal background checks, and the limiting of high-capacity magazines, and an effort to try and separate the drug trafficking and gun trafficking arteries that go across this country that fuel so much. And we really thought that we had momentum on our side, and it turned out that we didn't. And the Senate voted, shut down the conversation, I think by 2 or 3 votes. Mm-hmm. And I remember at the time saying to myself, well, I feel like I can't just stop because we had a setback. And so it has been our commitment since then to continue speaking about this. We don't claim to have all the answers. We don't want to tell people who are lawful gun owners who use their guns for hunting or for sport or for protection that we want to take away their guns. That's not what we're about. But we do want to raise the mirror into our collective society and say there are so many tragedies that are not preventable, but This one we have the authority and the capacity to change if we only would. So that's why we're here.
So are there plans for continued partnership with other leaders and religious denominations on the gun issue going forward? What are the next steps?
Well, I was just praying about that this morning, wondering, okay, so what do we do now? And I heard on the legislative front, quite honestly, there is more hopefulness in certain local constituents or local jurisdictions across the country where there are some really hopeful efforts taking place. Mm-hmm. Two things happened this week that we are going to work to promote. One is, removing from the House debate the issue of allowing gun silencers to be legal, which would mask the sound of guns, which would make it all the more difficult for law enforcement to detect an active shooter when they're in play. And the other is to put a ban on the kind of apparatus that this man added to his semi-automatic weapon to make it fully automatic, which you can buy for a couple $100 apparently on the internet. And so small chipping away efforts and then just raising the conversation. I frankly am spending more and more of my time talking to evangelical Christians and saying this is something that we ought to be able to talk about in larger conversations to see if we might find some common ground. So that's the work from my end, and I pray that others will continue at whatever level they might to bring about the change we need.
I'm curious, in your conversations with evangelicals, do you see some hope of cooperation?
Yes, in certain circles, I certainly do.
Yeah.
I also run into a very firm belief, and I don't disagree with it, that we must change the hearts of people, because if it's not a gun, it will be some other weapon that will, if a person has the motive to kill, they will kill, and I don't disagree with that. There is concern that we have a culture that is awash in violence in our entertainment and in our gaming industries, and in our families, and I don't disagree with that. So I think there is possibility for common ground. And quite honestly, as more and more people are affected by gun violence, the conversation changes. And so I pray that one day I might be able to bring Representative Gabrielle Gifford and Majority Whip Scalise into the same room to talk about what it's like to be a victim of gun violence and maybe talk about it from their perspective.
And that would be great.
To bridge that gap.
How can our listeners get involved in these initiatives?
Well, there are a number of organizations that are actively committed to this issue. If you just type into your search engine, gun violence prevention, you'll find a whole host of them, both from the religious and the secular world. So I would say, start where you are, start where your interests are, learn about the issue. This is an epidemic, but like the opioid epidemic, if you're not immediately affected by it, you don't know very much about it. Mm-hmm. And if you don't know much about it, you can be swayed by people who want to have you understand things on a very superficial level. And that's when we're dangerous as a society, when we think we know something when we actually don't.
The Right Reverend Mary Ann Budde is the Episcopal Bishop of Washington, D.C. This past week, the National Cathedral brought together a diverse group of faith leaders to speak out boldly on the moral and ethical imperative for our elected representatives to finally act on the epidemic of gun violence in our nation. Bishop Budde, I really want to thank you for taking a few minutes to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for your continued work on this and so many other issues.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. Significant assaults on LGBT rights are brewing at both the state and federal levels, and we'll get an update from Rabbi Jay Michelson. And later, Fred Clarkson on the political ascent of Alabama's Roy Ten Commandments Moore. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Rabbi Jay Michelson is an author, an activist, an attorney, a good friend, equally articulate, whether discussing our culture or our courts. Jay is a much-needed voice in a time such as this, and I am pleased to have him back with us today. Jay, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Great to be here.
No matter how much we've warned people over the years, everyone seems shocked at what the political religious right has been pushing in a newly friendly climate. Would you start, please, with the law that took effect Friday in Mississippi?
Sure. So on one level, the Mississippi law is very familiar, and on another level, it's quite new. The familiar part is that this is yet another religious freedom law, using the idea of religious liberty not as a shield against government action, but as a sword to discriminate against third parties. We'd never seen that before, at least not ratified by a court until the Hobby Lobby decision. But since then, we've seen that a lot in Indiana, for example, and in North Carolina and in other states. So in that regard, this is yet another religious liberty bill and quite familiar. I think what's new here is actually the extent of the bill and how many actions and behaviors are exempted from any kind of civil rights laws. So, for example, all kinds of medical services can be denied. All kinds of anything wedding related can be denied. Hotels, apartments, Airbnbs, all of that sort of thing are exempt from civil rights laws, so that you can discriminate against, mostly against LGBT people, but also against some other groups, as long as you have a religious reason to do so.
There have been some reports this would eventually have to be settled in the Supreme Court. You're a member of the SCOTUS bar. What do you think is going to happen here?
Well, it seems that parts of this law are clearly unconstitutional. The reason the law is even going into effect at all is that the lawsuit that has challenged it was just dismissed for lack of standing. And that's kind of a procedural, you could almost call it a technicality decision. So it hasn't really had its day in court at the Supreme Court anyway, in terms of its constitutionality. A lower court did find it unconstitutional in a number of different ways and for different reasons. And this is just an extremely broad exemption. You know, one reason it was found unconstitutional is that it exempts all of these different kind of actions, but only on one religious belief, which has to do with Leviticus God's creating genders, two different genders. So no other religious beliefs are afforded that kind of protection, and that seems to be a clear violation of the First Amendment.
Speaking of the Supreme Court, the justices have agreed to hear that notorious Colorado cake baker case. Is this a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, I think, you know, it's an interesting case. That's a really good question. I think it's good that at last the court is going to hear it. They've sort of been saying they would hear the case for a while, but I think because it was an 8-person court and they thought they might deadlock, or maybe just Chief Justice Roberts thought it would go away, he didn't want. It hadn't been heard for a while. It's been delayed for a long time. You know, I think it's unfortunate. It's a good case for the religious right because it's a very photogenic kind of plaintiff. Not that he's physically attractive, but that he's attractive in terms of his morality, his sincere religious beliefs. It is one person. It's this guy who's a cake baker, and so it's not a big company like Hobby Lobby, and so it's a very photogenic plaintiff for the religious right. So in that regard, it's troubling, perhaps. But I think it is actually a case where the lines are fairly clear. It's just not clear how the Supreme Court will come out.
So what could the wrong precedent in this case open the doors to?
So on the surface, this is just about a cake baker refusing to bake a cake for a same-sex couple. It's not a huge issue. There are generally other bakers. It's not in and of itself. It's still problematic that there could be a baker that says no gays allowed or no Jews allowed or no mixed race couples allowed or other things like that, just because they have a religious pretext. The really troubling part, as you point out, is the effects that this precedent could actually have. So if a cake baker, then why not any other provision of any kind of services? Where do you draw the line between an artist like a cake baker and, you know, a lawyer or an accountant? Why is one person's personal services different from another? And if you go down that slippery slope and you say that it's possible for people to take exemptions, even though they're incorporated as businesses, and that's a critical point, right? It's a bakery, not just a baker. It's a business that's doing business under the laws of the state of Colorado. Then you've really opened the door to any kind of religious exemption. And you've really said that this right is not equal to other civil rights.
Jay, we were talking about the various anti-LGBT attacks happening right now at the state and federal levels. I'd really like to know what you think the end game is. Let's hope the most extreme fringe of the political religious right isn't calling all the shots right now, but we can't rule out the possibility that they are. So if we suppose for a minute that they are, what is it that they would want to see happen to gay people in America?
Well, I think I have two answers to that. As you point out, there's the right wing and the extreme right wing. And I think they do have, you know, that they're on a scale of what the end game actually is. In the short term or midterm, let's say, the end game is to chip away at the right to same-sex marriage and to anti-discrimination, piece by piece by piece. And the playbook for how to do that is abortion. It's now, in some parts of the country, more difficult to get a legal abortion today than it is, let's say, a year or two after Roe versus Wade came out. And one step at a time, eventually really restricting the underlying right. And that's the end game on the sort of conventional political Christian right. You know, as you point out, there's also the extreme end, whether they're dominionists or others who don't really believe in the concept of separation of church and state. And so there, it's not just what happens to gay people, but what happens to the republic as at large. And the end game there is, just as future Senator, probably Roy Moore from Alabama, has said, there's no difference between God's law and the foundations of our human law. And as soon as you decide, in their interpretation, of course, of what God's law is, picking and choosing. You know, God's law when it comes to marriage includes polygamy and concubines and lots of slavery. Presumably, they don't mean that God's law, but the God's law that they have selectively interpreted from what the Bible says clearly doesn't have very kind things to say about gay people, and so the civil law would follow suit. And it's that blending, the notion of dominionism to take over the so-called seven mountains of society, of which government is one, that's really troubling in the extreme. And it's not clear that that part of the right wing is calling the shots, as you point out, but their end game is a transformation of the United States into a Christian nation, legally as well as morally.
Do you think we'll be seeing more Roy Moores running for office?
Oh, absolutely. We are already seeing more Roy Moores running for office. You know, Alabama is obviously a somewhat special case. It's Alabama. I'm not sure we'll see more Roy Moores in the Senate, but in state legislatures all across the country, there are other Roy Moores who are running, people who expressly say that this is a Christian nation, again, in their very narrow interpretation of what that means. And it's certainly taking place. You know, on an optimistic level, this is kind of the last gasp of a population that is declining in influence. But there's no reason to be sanguine about it. It's quite a disturbing development, and absolutely one that's going to continue.
Jay, you wrote a thought-provoking column in the Daily Beast after the Vegas massacre. The headline is, "Why Do Conservatives Blame Gun Violence on a Sick World? The Bible." What do you mean by that?
So I think, you know, there's a liberal conception that folks who are against, let's say, you know, gun control are either hoodwinked by the NRA or are themselves just gun-toting fanatics and crazy people. And, you know, I think that's both incorrect and, more importantly, really unhelpful. And so I was interested in a little bit of a deeper dive into why people would oppose what many of us would see as common sense gun control. So not taking away handguns from people, but let's say, you know, banning the kinds of semi-automatic weapons that were used in the Vegas massacre. And you know, the closer you look at the causes for gun violence that the right is saying are out there, right? Because it is obviously, they must have some explanation. And the closer you look at that explanation, the more biblical it seems, that this is a sick world. We're in a period of decline. And if you align that with what both the Old Testament and the New Testament say, whether it's the prophets or the Gospels, it's basically the same message, that we're sinful human beings. And it doesn't matter about the gun technology or changing our understandings of what's reasonable control of firearms in the 21st century. It just has to do with the fact that our society is in bad shape. And as I point out in the column, it's always been 5 minutes to midnight, according to this kind of conservative understanding of biblical morality. I'll hasten to say that's not the only understanding of biblical morality. But according to this understanding, it's always been the worst time ever. There's always been some better time in the past. And that's almost exactly the kind of rhetoric that you see coming out of the right now, that this gun violence has to do with our sick society.
Jay, if that's how many of them see it, then there's not much chance for any policy changes, is there? In fact, there's not much need for any policy changes if the problem is a spiritually sick world.
Well, I'm not that pessimistic. I think, first of all, that's just one view. And when you get to the nitty-gritty of who's controlling state legislatures and Congress, there the liberal answer is a little more correct. You know, there it is, the National Rifle Association and powers of lobbyists and so forth. If you look at the public opinion polls, a majority of Americans do support a number of restrictions on handguns, not selling them to mentally ill people, for example, and a wholesale restriction on semi-automatic weapons, which have no legitimate hunting use and no real use for self-defense either. So I'm not optimistic because the NRA has locked this up. I actually feel very pessimistic, but I think that the values conversation in this case still allows for some moderate steps on gun control if we can actually break through some of the denialism that's now holding sway in Congress.
Jay Michelson is the legal affairs columnist at the Daily Beast. He is a rabbi, a meditation teacher, an attorney, an activist. Jay is also the author of 6 books, including God Versus Gay, The Religious Case for Equality, and The Gate of Tears, Sadness and the Spiritual Path. Jay, it's always valuable to talk with you, and you are so kind to give us parts of your time that we need so much. Thanks for being with us once again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you.
So many other disasters have kept the headlines full in recent weeks that you'd be forgiven for not having followed the Republican primary for U.S. Senate in Alabama. But there are plenty of reasons for serious concern, at least 10 of them, and I'm pleased to be able to welcome one of the nation's foremost Moore watchers, Frederick Clarkson, back to State of Belief Radio. Fred, thanks for being with us again.
Well, thanks for having me. I don't know if being a foremost Moore watcher is a dubious distinction or not, but I guess we'll go with that.
Can I ask you to start with just a summary of Moore's greatest hits? Why has he been on your radar for all of these years?
All the world's a stage for Roy Moore in terms of advancing a distinctly theocratic point of view. He first came to national attention because of the local court judge. He had a hand-carved display, hand-carved display of the Ten Commandments, opened court sessions with prayer, and led jurors in prayer, and ultimately got sued. And that led to the notoriety that allowed him to ride that wave to being elected statewide to be Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court, where he was soon removed from office because he had installed a granite monument to the Ten Commandments in the foyer of the state courthouse, and defied a federal court judge who ordered him to remove it. So he was removed from the bench. Then, some years later, he managed to be reelected as Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court and defied yet another federal judge who wanted county probate officers to issue state or marriage licenses to same-sex couples, and Judge Moore had tried to prevent them from doing that. So this is a man who's taken his particular theocratic point of view about the foundational idea of the Ten Commandments and law and tried to use the courtrooms and the national media stage to get his point of view across.
Fred, did you ever think Roy Moore's career would take a turn to national politics like this?
I didn't, but that's one of the interesting things about Roy Moore. He's full of surprises.
So do you think it's been his anti-gay positions or his utter contempt for the U.S. Constitution that's helped him more in his political career?
Well, certainly both and more. Simply because he's a colorful character. I mean, his views aside, he's a throwback to another age of populist Southern politicians. As we saw from this last campaign, he'll wear a leather cowboy vest and a white cowboy hat and wave a gun around, and he even rode a horse to the polls on Election Day. I think where Trump is a deal maker primarily, and he is going to have to make deals with Democrats. He already said that he would, and he has, you know, on certain issues because the Republican caucus is in gridlock. Roy Moore is coming to Washington not to be a deal maker. He is there to make it work, to make the Senate work less well, and to try to be a monkey wrench, as it were, in the works of a system that he thinks has become ungodly. And to put a monkey wrench into the creeping federal secularism that he sees mm-hmm. that's out to crush Christianity as he understands it. Mm-hmm.
Is it that the voters who supported Moore are poorly informed, or are they actually enthusiastic about this man's outrageous positions?
Well, I think it's both. I think there are, as always, there are many what we used to call low-information voters. And any politician gets that far in public life, a long career, multiple runs for state office, he's got name recognition. You know, he's got a name. He's the Ten Commandments judge. Mm-hmm. So some people just know him, and they think he's a character, and they would rather have him. Who's going to stick it to the man. He's going to stick it to the people who aren't delivering for him, regardless of party. And he has that populist appeal.
Fred, for a moment, and this is not a political advertisement at all. I'm asking you to answer a question. Why would you not vote for Roy Moore to become a United States senator?
Well, you know, I think I feel like most Americans that we sometimes we talk about government as if it's a different thing. It's like the government, but the government is us. Mm-hmm. At its best, it's our best expression of the things that we want to do together. Mm-hmm. As a people in our communities and in our nation. And that's where our source of national pride comes from and our national embarrassment when that happens. Roy Moore doesn't share that vision. He sees government as currently constructed as a violation of his vision of God's laws and something that needs to be so fundamentally changed it would be unrecognizable to the rest of us in all of our religious diversity. So, I think that Roy Moore is a threat to the broadest swath of our identity as Americans and as a constitutional government.
How would he see God's law impacting the national budget?
Oh, well, I think he would see God's law as making it much less, for one thing. I think that he has a vision of government not being responsible, say, for, health, education, and welfare, mm-hmm. as he of his ilk like to put it. Mm-hmm. So we would see he would agree with those who want to eliminate various federal departments, lots of funding for lots of federal programs. And like I said earlier, when it comes to health care, he would repeal, not replace. Mm-hmm. So as a military man, he sees the government as functioning primarily for defense. Mm-hmm. And not very much for delivery of services.
Hmm. Would public education become a Sunday school class?
If there's any public education at all, yes. I think, without really being certain, but I think that Roy Moore's view on the use of funds for public religious instruction is a bad use of public funds. Taxpayers shouldn't have to pay other people to figure out what to do with their own money.
Mm, okay. Well, let me ask you, is there even a tiny chance in your mind that this marks the beginning of a whole new wave of far-right extremism washing over our country, or is Moore a lone wolf?
Well, he's both. I think what we saw in the runoff with Donald Trump supporting one candidate and Steve Bannon and the alt-right supporting Moore, we're seeing what there is of the alt-right more openly and specifically unifying with mm-hmm. The Christian right candidate. Mm-hmm. I think we will see more of that now. And I haven't asked this before, but Moore is a singular figure and a very unconventional politician and a successful one. There aren't very many people with that level of notoriety and success out there to be a far-right challenge to more conventional politicians. Mm-hmm. But that said, there's a wealthy billionaire named Mercer, and there's who's the bankroller of Steve Bannon and Breitbart News, are seeking to create that kind of movement. So Moore may very well turn out to be a success story for them that they can point to. But they may not have a lot of candidates as effective as Roy Moore.
Fred, what's the antidote, or is there an antidote? Is there a way communities can try to inoculate themselves against this kind of ignorant extremism before it's too late?
Well, I do. And, Martin Luther King was right, and it's never too late to do the right thing. I think that we, as a society, as Americans, have become complacent about what it takes to make democracy go. And it takes a lot more vigorous and wider participation. Waiting until you see who's on the ballot and then voting, if you do, is not good enough. Mm-hmm. Many more people need to be registered voters, need to be informed about candidates, and have a better political knowledge and vocabulary to understand what the difference between a Roy Moore conservative and a Luther Strange conservative is, and to learn the skills of electoral democracy. I mean, just figuring out where your polling price is a pretty low bar. So, yeah, I think we're really talking about jump-starting the basic mechanisms of citizen participation in electoral democracy. That is the answer that was given, you know, and created and worked hard for across a couple of centuries now to make it possible for ordinary people to have a voice in government. And I think it's a use-it-or-lose-it situation.
That's such a powerful answer. From everything you know about Roy Moore, what kind of senator would you expect him to be?
Well, I think if we look to the first term of Ted Cruz, when he was a freshman senator from Texas, and his efforts to almost single-handedly stop the federal government from functioning, shutting the government down for a period of time, and costing the federal government billions of dollars, I think that kind of grandstanding, those kinds of gestures, that kind of iconoclastic abuse of senatorial privilege will mark his career in the Senate.
How can he take, will he take, the oath of office for a senator? He says that the only law that he obeys is the law of God. We're asking in that oath of office to pledge to defend the Constitution and to make that the primary guide in our democracy. Can he do that?
In his mind, yes. He sees the Constitution as a vehicle for the implementation of God's law rather than as a vehicle for equal rights for all in the way that most of us have come to see it. So, yeah, he doesn't see any contradiction there at all. He's going to fight for his view of the Constitution and think he's doing the right thing.
Fred, your expertise at the collision of religion and politics has never been as vitally important as it is now. Unfortunately, the more I talk with you, the more afraid I get for what's happening in our country. Thank you for what you do. I know we'll be talking again soon, but for now, thanks for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thanks for doing what you do well, too, Elton. Many thanks for the kind words. I hope that we can make some good things happen.
Before we go, this has been another terrible week in our country. I have felt the heavy shroud of grief evoked by so many lives needlessly snuffed out by a gunman who should never have been in possession of the cache of weapons he used in his deadly assault on people gathered to enjoy country music. Like you, I'm sure, I have little hope of Congress making significant changes in the gun laws of our country. Congress seems to forget that we are a democracy, and when 90% of the citizens want major changes in gun laws, they should pay more attention to the citizens than they do to the National Rifle Association. I'm sad, and I'm angry, and I'm looking for hope about the character and moral courage of leaders in our nation's government. For me, this week also has been almost unbearable because of the behavior and rhetoric of our insensitive president. At the beginning of the week, I was encouraged by the words and actions of the Secretary of State when he assured the nation that he was working hard to establish a conversation with leaders in North Korea and that he was determined to replace threats of war with dialogues focused on peace. Then came shock and anger and disgust. The leader of the free world, the President of the United States, told the would-be peacemaking Secretary of State that his efforts were useless and he needed to stop what he was doing. Never before have I known a president that wanted to give up on a peaceful world, that instructed one of his cabinet members to stop efforts to assure peace. Who is this man? How does one explain his thoughts? Obviously, the president is devoid of sensitivity and oblivious to the kind of massive destruction that could result from silence in relation to North Korea. What is he thinking? And then came the president's trip to Puerto Rico and his attempt to tell the hurting people there that they had not experienced a major crisis because of a major hurricane, because not enough people had died. President Trump told those fatigued from suffering people that he would have to think about the kind of aid that we might provide for them. Amid people with no electricity, little food, and thirst for water, the president playfully threw paper towels into the midst of people who needed comfort and promise and a feeling that they could recover and live. But the president either had no thought about offering such care and rhetoric, or he had no time for it, or he was incapable of doing it. Words from one of my seminary professors have been on my mind. A person who is not hurting should never try to tell a person who is hurting how loud to yell. Obviously, our president is so preoccupied with his mythical successes and diminishing power that he has no time for compassion and generosity. Honestly, friends, how could this be? I keep asking that myself. How could we see and hear the President of the United States fail so miserably in empathy and caring? Of course, I think the answer to my question takes us right back to his preference to talk about war rather than to encourage his staff to make peace. You know, maybe the most troubling of all for me this week is once again facing a hard and frightening reality. Our nation elected this man as president. There was no coup. We had an election, and he won. We have the president that the voters in our nation chose. Critiquing his behavior will do little good. He is who he is, and he is who he has always been. Complaints do little good. Now, as a minister, maybe I should pray for him and our country, knowing that the president doesn't like people kneeling. But frankly, prayers are not enough. Action must accompany any meditation. I only find a modicum of peace when I stare at the chaos of the president's leadership and lack of compassion as well as competence, and resolve to encourage all with the power to do so to remove him from his office. Never before have we so badly needed strong citizens eager to engage in real politics toward the end of both advocating for and working for new leadership, while we ourselves try to bring the empathy, care, and generosity of help to our nation, because it's not getting it, those essentials, from our leaders. I encourage you in this sad time to do the best of work. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. We'll use your money responsibly. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to someone you know, please share it with them. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussion. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.